The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
All right, Scott, welcome to The Exchange. I'm Dominic Chu in for Kelly M today, and here's what's ahead on the show. The Fed was less hawkish than feared, so what does that mean for investors from here on out? Our market guest says it means you don't want to get caught with FOMO. She's here with what she means and what she's buying. Plus, no labor pains for this stock today. Shares her freelance job platform, Upwork, higher on earnings and stronger guidance. The CEO joins us with the trends she's seeing and the clues it may provide for tomorrow's big jobs report. And here comes Apple. Our trader is poised to take a position in it. She tells us what she's watching on that name and two others getting ready to report as well. That's ahead in Earnings Exchange. But we begin with today's markets, and generally speaking, we're talking about some moves to the upside overall. At the highs of the session, the Dow was up about 245 points. We were down about 8 points at the lows of the session. Right now, the Dow Industrial is up 150 points, one half of 1% gain there, 38,060. The S&P 500 is at 5,038, up 20 points, over about half of 1% as well. The NASDAQ composite up about 0.75%, 130 points to the upside, 15,736 by 28. The 10-year note yield just hovering below 4.6%, 4.591 the last trade there. If you take a look at that Treasury complex overall, broadly speaking, yields have been lower across many parts of the yield curve, of course, throughout the course of this week. A lot of it has to do with the Fed announcement for rates just yesterday. The 2-year note yield, 4.90%. The 10-year note yield, just about unchanged right now, again, 4.91%. And the 30-year long bond, 4.74%. All of this ahead of the big jobs report. And then the stock in focus today will be Apple. It's the main event this afternoon. The second biggest stock in the S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 is now getting slated to report their results after the closing bell. It's broadly been an underperformer in mega cap land over the course of the last year and certainly the year-to-date period. You can see right now, currently $172 a share. It's sitting right at its 50-day average price on a rolling basis. That's been a kind of cap, if you will, over the course of the last 3 or 4 months or so. So you'll see whether or not there is any kind of a breakout today. And by the way, Apple options markets right now are implying what could be a plus or minus 4% move in Apple shares after it reports results. Over the last 8 earnings reports, it has been plus or minus 3.5%. So traders, at least at this point, are pricing in a slightly more volatile report than over the last 8 times it's done so. Keep an eye on those Apple shares. Well, we begin with the latest read on the labor market. Initial jobless claims coming in at 208,000. By the way, look at that. It's unchanged from the prior week and at the lowest level since mid-February. And as we count down to the big April jobs report tomorrow, our next guest, too, isn't seeing much weakness. In fact, he says April is setting up to be a better month than the month of March. Let's welcome back Evan Sohn, chairman of Recruiter.com, knows a thing or two about the jobs market overall. Evan, we've seen a slew of data, especially when it comes to employment numbers, wage numbers. On balance, what do you think that sets us up for tomorrow for non-farm payrolls?
It is a very tight market, and everyone keeps saying that it's a tight market. We saw the Recruiter Index, which we do monthly. Salaries were about 48% said, 68% said unchanged. So really very little changes on the salary levels. You look at the JOLTS report and 15% fewer quit rates than a year ago. So 3.5 million people quit in March, which is down 15% from where they were in March of 23. So hiring was at a 10% difference year over year less. But really, really interesting to watch that the salaries are stable. What that really tells you is that it's going to be harder to get people to leave their job to go take another job. We saw a very significant number of candidates through the Recruiter Index actually already having 2 or more jobs in the past 2 years. So there are jobs that are out there. Even though the open jobs we saw from the ORA job report ticked up by 1%. What was really interesting, Dominic, was that the number of jobs that were remote only actually doubled from 11% to 22% of the jobs that the recruiters were working on. This is another indication of a tight job market. So while I might want to create a culture that has either an in-person environment or a hybrid environment, in order to fill these roles, I'm going to have to go outside my geographic area. What you're seeing right now on the screen is that the open roles, the number of jobs that the recruiters were working on, also increased from 10 jobs in March to 13.5 open roles per recruiter in April. So there are jobs there. These are the knowledge worker jobs. We saw the salary, the average salary of those jobs increase from that $80,000 to $100,000 range to $100,000 to $150,000 range, which is really that knowledge worker level.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack. So let's start with where you just left. There's a lot. We are concerned about inflation right now, and people look at the wage numbers. They look at how many people are quitting their jobs to take new ones, presumably, hopefully, with higher paying aspects to those particular jobs they're moving into. We are starting to see signs that that's slowing down. People aren't hopping as much and getting higher pay. That's good for the inflation story, not as good for the wage story, but it's good for inflation. But you're telling us at the same time it's becoming competitive in certain other parts of the market to get even workers in the door. What exactly is the kind of counterbalance there? What's tipping the scale one way or the other? And with that, if it's going to be that way in the coming months, is there any sign that we would look for that says that this is reversing course at some point down the line?
Excellent questions. I don't think it's reversing anytime soon. We saw AI-related jobs increase 24% March to April. So companies are hiring. They're just getting very particular in what they're hiring. And if I need those AI jobs, and we saw some sectors increase by over 100%, so really significant going on there on the AI hiring, it's going to be difficult. You know, what really moved people a lot a couple of years ago, the job hopper economy, as you were talking about it, was the increase of wages. And if salaries are going to remain stable, why would I leave a job? I'm going to leave for a better work-life balance. Maybe they're letting me work remotely, et cetera. And I think that's really, really what's changing. Now, what you're seeing here now in the hottest job category, while healthcare and medical are again in the top category, it actually went down by 8%. That's really significant, because if you looked at the JOLTS number, the BLS numbers every single month, the job data that really came out was showing really being pulled by government jobs as well as healthcare jobs. And so the healthcare market represented about 33% of the jobs of the recruiters in the recruiter index, but that's down 8% from where it was a month ago.
And not just that. So you mentioned, I'd like to dig into that more, where all these jobs and what this data suggests, where the activity is. You mentioned all of this positivity, but it seems as though there's only certain jobs in the economy that can be done on this kind of remote or hybrid basis. It certainly isn't in manufacturing or industrial, where people have to make things. It is those knowledge-based areas of the market. So as we look in aggregate about these job stats, how much salt grain-wise do we have to take with it if it's just telling us about what certain types of industries are doing with their jobs, fully remote or otherwise, hybrid or otherwise, versus other aspects of the economy overall?
Great question. Look, I think healthcare, you're seeing healthcare allow a hybrid environment where you're going to work in the office n number of days, whether that's the more knowledge worker involved in healthcare or even other practitioners that are dealing with patients in a telemedicine perspective. You know, people are adopting to where the labor is. You're about to have Upwork on. That's all about contract labor. When you can't find full-time labor, you move to contract labor. When you can't find in-person labor, you're going to move to remote labor. And I think what's really important to look out for really are the AI jobs. That's a very big increase, and we're seeing that, you know, is an increase in the apparel and fashion industry even. So not just the IT sector and the financial sector on the AI jobs, but in other industries. So there are jobs out there. The job market is still, it's still open jobs. Just you're going to be more particular in finding those actual talent, which is why the recruiters as a staffing, as an industry, didn't make it to the top five, but it's in the top 10. in terms of short sought after. And that's usually a leading indicator, Dominic, of what's to come in the market.
All right. Evan Sohn with the State of Play in Jobs. Thank you very much. We'll see you sometime after this jobs report comes out. All right, we've got a news alert now on Pioneer Natural Resources. Pippa Stevens has that story. Hi, Pippa.
Hey, Donald. Well, the FTC has decided to send allegations against Pioneer's founder, Scott Sheffield, to the Justice Department, according to reports. The FTC accuses him of trying to collude with OPEC in order to keep oil and gas output down, which the FTC said increases prices at the pump for Americans. Now, this, of course, coming in the context of that mega merger, $60 billion of Exxon taking over Pioneer. The FTC officially gave the green light on that merger this morning. But as part of that, Exxon agreed that Scott Sheffield would not join the board of Exxon as initially was the plan. Now, earlier today, Pioneer said in a statement that they disagreed and were surprised by the FTC's complaints against Mr. Sheffield. Dom?
All right, Pippa Stevens with Lilius there. Thank you very much. Turning back down to the markets, Fed Chair Jerome Powell less hawkish than feared yesterday. While that sent market rate cut probabilities up a little bit, but for each month, it did not move up the timeline. The first cut is not expected until the end of the year still. So where does that leave investors? Our next guest says it should not leave them on the sidelines. Joining us now is Julie Beal, the chief market strategist, also portfolio manager at Kayne Anderson. Julia, thank you very much for being here with us. I'm sorry we couldn't get the video link up for you. Technical difficulties there. But take us through the rate picture right now as you see it and why people and investors should not stay on the sidelines in this market.
Right. Well, I think if you look at the outlook overall, there's a lot of balance because we have a strong economic backdrop with employment very strong, wages very strong. Sentiment is getting a little bit softer, and I think that's really a function of oil prices. But then we also have $1 trillion of credit card debt. We have a deficit that is more in line with 7% unemployment than 4%. And so I think there's a lot of puts and takes, and what that means is there's not a lot of leadership in the market, and there's not a lot of conviction one way or the other. What we think is it's really hard to understand what the outlook is going to look like for the next 12 months. You really do want to stay invested. There are enough positives to really support, but you want to focus on quality so that you're protected if the economy does weaken.
Okay, so that quality, where do you find it, Julie? Where do you find that quality? Is it defensive names? Is it in real estate? I mean, it seems very uncertain given the rate outlook.
I think it's less about sectors, and it's really more about the individual companies and the competitive dynamics that they have. So businesses that have low levels of leverage are really absolutely critical in this environment. Doesn't matter if it's small cap, mid cap, or large, you really want a very pristine balance sheet. But I think right now, if I look at earnings, there's a lot of volatility in earnings, which to me signals that investors are using the rate picture to kind of decide where valuations need to be, and that at earnings, we have a true up based on fundamentals. So I think right now, the place you want to be is in companies that have durability to their earnings, not necessarily just very strong growth. And so companies that are like, I would think of a Verisk or a Fair Isaac, where you have a lot of durability to the earnings, you can kind of count on them in a way that you can't with some of these flashier, higher growth companies.
Now, if you take a look at those, the leverage thing is very much a part of the story right now, given the fact that certain companies that rely on debt markets may be dealing with higher interest rates. I wonder, are your clients also asking you about whether or not they should be gravitating towards other income areas of the market, specifically corporate credit, whether that's investment grade or even high yield or junk debt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting to be an equity investor right now when you have opportunities for fixed income, you know, in the 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. That's, you know, equity-like returns for investors. And so if you're in equities and you're concerned about the level of volatility, some of that is very, very compelling. I think my concern is most of these, you know, a lot of this debt was raised in the absolute best of times. And so I have a little bit of a concern that some of this junk or private credit may not be of the quality that we would hope for. So I think absolutely there are really good opportunities to be had in the fixed income markets, but I still think you have to have a focus on quality even there.
Okay, now one last thing before we let you go. You mentioned this overarching theme of being invested, staying in the markets overall. Just how big, Julie, could any potential drawdown be in terms of not scaring somebody? Could it be 5, 10%? Could it be even deeper than that this time around? We've seen some volatility that gives some, at least some investors, some pause.
Yeah, absolutely. Just look at the last 3 years, right? I don't think anyone could have predicted the drawdown that we saw in 2022, neither the rally in 2023, right? So I think that's the real challenge for all investors, not just, you know, professional institutional investors, is the ability to kind of sit on your hands when there is this volatility. You know, there's that saying, don't just sit there, do something. And, you know, we kind of believe, actually, don't just do that, do something, sit there, own the good quality names and just do your best to kind of sit through the volatility.
All right. Julie Beal, thank you very much. We'll get you on here again soon. And this time, maybe we'll see you on the video link. All right. Coming up on the show, who says denim is dead? Contour Brands, which is the maker of Lee and Wrangler jeans, amongst other brands, is hitting a new all-time high on the back of a big earnings beat. We're going to speak with the CEO exclusively coming up next about the quarter, their forecast, and how denim is paying dividends for investors. Plus, a second C-suite view, and this time you heard it before, from the head of freelance work platform Upwork. Those shares are higher today on the heels of their results. We'll get that CEO's take on the labor market ahead of tomorrow's all-important non-farm payrolls report. The Exchange, jam-packed, is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of clothing company Contour Brands hitting a new record high today after they beat first quarter profit expectations. Those shares are up nearly 11% so far this afternoon, trading just below their intraday high of $69.69. Now, this is the parent company of Wrangler and Lee brands. It also raised its full-year outlook, citing confidence in brand investments despite a tougher backdrop. Still, though, Contour saw revenue slide 5% this past quarter and says it could see a 1% decline for the full year of 2024. Let's now dive further into those results with Contour Brand CEO Scott Baxter. Scott, thank you very much for being with us here. And I see you're wearing the product. I do see the denim on there right now. Talk to us about what's driving this record result here. Denim is a big deal. It's basically you and Levi Strauss, the brands that everybody knows and understands. What is it about denim that makes it such a good business right now?
You know, it's the casualization. Thanks for having me on, Don. It's the casualization of what's happening around the world right now as we've all come back to work the last year and a half. And people are casual. Denim's acceptable everywhere you go. And we make really great product. And on top of that, we're in other categories, too, that are driving our success, like outdoors and T-shirts and things like that.
Now, this is a denim, and you know, a denim dynamic, if you will, that has been brewing for quite some time now, and arguably maybe skyrocketed a little bit because of the pandemic and everything else that's been going on. What exactly is that casualization trend going to look like in the coming years? How much does it have in terms of momentum? And how exactly do you capitalize on it with Lee and Wrangler versus other denim brands out there?
Well, I think it's got a long way to go. And the key, though, is you've got to stay ahead of your consumer and really think about what they're looking for. So you've got to have a strong insights business, which we do, you know, embedded in our culture. I'll give you a great example of that. You know, our Lee consumer, the male Lee consumer, really indexes to golf, indexes to watching golf and playing golf. So we just kicked off a whole Lee Golf Line here this past month, and it's done exceptionally well right out of the gate. But I think it's got a lot of legs. It's got a lot of legs globally. But it's not just denim for a company like us. Like I mentioned, it's tops, it's outdoor, it's T-shirts. It's all types of different product that go ahead and make up the full and entire portfolio that keeps us rolling. And we think it's got a lot of momentum and a lot of legs. And I think part of that, too, has to do with the brand heat. You know, we've had some really successful collaborations and collections. We've got our Lainey Wilson collection coming out here at the end of the year, which is really going to be dynamite. We're really looking forward to it. And she's helped us design that because she has a real passion for apparel. So that type of brand heat and bringing those things to the market help keep us in the forefront of what our consumers are looking for.
Those are a lot of different silos you're talking about. You're talking about Lainey Wilson. Yep. You're talking about rodeos. You're talking about a Yellowstone watching audience. You just mentioned at the same time a new golf-focused line for Lee. Where exactly is that growth coming from as you look at these different verticals, these different silos? Where do you see the most growth coming from?
Well, I think North America, our biggest market, will be a real strong driver for us going forward. We have some really nice collections coming out here. Our momentum here is extremely strong. We've got smaller businesses in Europe and Asia, but they're coming on really nicely. Asia and China have come out of the pandemic very nicely, so we're positioning that business to do really well. We're investing in that business fairly significantly, too. Europe has been a little bit more difficult here the last year or two, and we're hoping that that comes out here towards the end of the year. We do see some green shoots. But North America being our biggest market is really important for us, and us driving our core brands, Lee and Wrangler, in that market really carry the momentum for us going forward.
You know, one of the things that, I mentioned Levi's before, it's only because they're a bigger in terms of market cap than you guys are. They also trade at a premium valuation to where you guys are as well. They have about 3 or 4 percentage or you know valuation points in terms of price to earnings multiple next year higher than you. They've also emphasized their direct to consumer verticals in the past and how that's a strength of their operation. Can you take us through what your direct to consumer strategy is? Is it a bigger part of your business, or is it mostly still department stores and other stores that are selling your product?
Yeah, I certainly can. Actually, it's the biggest opportunity for us throughout the globe, really, because we were more of a wholesale, you know, business when we got spun out 5 years ago. And now we've got this platform from a D2C, both, you know, hard physical stores and also e-commerce. Both are smaller businesses relative to our peer set, and that just creates a bigger opportunity. So we've been investing pretty heavily in both. This coming year, we're going to be building stores in North America. We're going to be building stores in Asia. We're going to be refurbishing a ton of stores in China, which is really significant. I talked about that in our call this morning. And then our e-commerce platforms have grown significantly here over the last 5 years. But the key is they still have a lot of room to grow because we still are under-indexed in those areas. And that helps us to talk and, you know, communicate better with the consumer when we have that one-on-one relationship from an e-com or direct-to-consumer store business.
And Scott, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask one final question of you, because you are such a consumer-focused company. I'd like your take as to what you think the state of the American consumer is as you see it. We've been seeing some mixed signals in this market. It seems as though this is a transitory phase about going between consumer strength to relative weakness. Is the American consumer strong?
The American consumer is in fairly good shape. I do believe it's going to get better. I think we'll see inflation kind of ebb here a little bit towards the end of the year and going into next year. Our folks and our consumers are still working, which is important. There's been a little wage inflation, which is important. I think you set up that dynamic right there, and I think things look pretty good for 25. In addition to the fact, someone like us, the bulk of our products are sold between $20 and $40, and they're used for work and recreation, so people need our product. And that bodes really well for us when you can buy a trusted brand at a value price like Wrangler and Lee.
All right. Scott Baxter, CEO of Contour Brands, parent company of Lee and Wrangler Jeans. Thank you very much. Please come again and see us soon.
You bet. Thanks. Have
All right.
Day.
Okay. Well, coming up on the show, Peloton is erasing its earlier gains after reporting a wider-than-expected loss, a 15% workforce reduction plan, and a CEO change again. We've got the details and a closer look at the C-suite shuffle coming up next. And as we head out to break, here's a look at some of today's earnings movers. Allstate slightly outperforming the other two insurers that reported results, as you can see there, between Aflac and MetLife. Meantime, Zillow's down 6% after forecasting weaker than expected second quarter sales. And DoorDash is plunging 12% after posting a wider than expected first quarter loss. in a second quarter forecast that fell short of Wall Street's estimates. The stock is now flirting with its worst day on record. We're back after this.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Markets right now are generally higher. You can see here the Dow Industrial is just up about 2/3 of 1%, 38,143, up 240 points. The S&P 500, 5,052. It's up 34 points, about 3/4 of 1%. And the NASDAQ Composite, 15,795, 190 points to the upside there. That tech trade pacing the advance up about 1.25%. Here are some of the movers this hour. Qualcomm is leading the NASDAQ after posting an earnings beat and giving guidance that beat Wall Street's estimates. Those shares, you can see they're up roughly 10% in the trade. Now let's send it over to Pippa Stevens for a CNBC News update. Hi, Pippa.
Hey, Dom. Before the Donald Trump hush money trial took a lunch break, the defense started their cross-examination of Keith Davidson, the former lawyer for Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. The defense tried to paint Davidson as unethical, saying he made a career helping clients extort hush money from celebrities. White House officials say Russia has been quietly shipping fuel to North Korea over the limit set by the UN and suggested there could be new sanctions as a result. It comes after a UN panel that monitored the enforcement of sanctions against North Korea disbanded after Russia vetoed its renewal. The Russian and North Korean UN missions have yet to respond. And Japan's Moon Sniper lander has survived its third lunar night after its initial landing back in January. Even though it wasn't designed to survive the two-week-long frigid conditions, Japan's space agency says it's monitoring the lander's condition to see which parts could be deteriorating as it continues to endure the environment. Dom?
All right, Pippa Stevens with the news update. Thank you very much for that. Time for a little show and tell, where we show you a chart and then tell you the story. Now, Peloton is giving up its earlier gains today after announcing a wider-than-expected loss, a 15% workforce reduction, and the exit of CEO Barry McCarthy. But let's take a step back and look at how we got to where we are today. Remember, that stock stumbled out of the gate, falling 11% in its public debut after opening below its IPO price of $29 a share. Less than 6 months later, the pandemic hit. Big deal for Peloton. In January of 2021, the stock closed at a record high. That May of that year, the company then recalled all of its treadmills over safety concerns and then announced plans to build its first American factory. But that stock continued to struggle. About 9 months later, founder John Foley stepped down and the CEO and the company introduced former Netflix and Spotify chief financial officer Barry McCarthy as its next chief executive, highlighting his experience with managing subscription-type business models and digital streaming companies. Now, in his first year as CEO, McCarthy cut Peloton's workforce by more than half. And then last February, after 8 consecutive quarters of losses, he told CNBC he was ready to pivot from trying to keep the company alive to actually growing it. Well, shares are now down nearly 80% in the past 15 months, and including today's move, they're down 90% under his tenure and 97% from their all-time closing high. So Peloton shares, certainly a volatile ride over the last several years. Well, coming up on the show, Apple has yet to post a positive month in the year 2024, and our traders have been profiting off that decline since late last year. We'll look at how to trade it into earnings and whether Apple can actually break out of its recent slump. And as we head out to break, here's a look at some of the names falling to new 52-week lows or worse, including CVS Health, Mosaic, Penn Entertainment, Etsy, and Wolfspeed as well. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of Upwork are higher after stronger than expected quarterly earnings and both second quarter and full year guidance. The results strong enough to earn Upwork an upgrade from analysts at BTIG to a buy rating from a prior neutral, saying impressive client growth is a harbinger of more good things to come. So let's talk more about this. Joining me now with more on those numbers is Hayden Brown, the CEO of Upwork. Hayden, it's great to be with you. And it's always great to get your thoughts, especially when it comes to the jobs-related economy. We had Evan Sohn at Recruiter.com earlier give you a bit of a shout-out with regard to wanting to hear what you had to say about the jobs market. He mentioned that you are a contract work platform. Some folks call you a gig work platform, but take us through what you think Upwork really is at this point in your company's history.
Thanks, Dom. You know, what we do is we serve clients and talent with the most cutting edge ways to work now. And we solve the problem that so many companies have around how to get access to the skills that they need, the flexibility they need in terms of their workforce, which is such a top of mind topic for so many executives. They're looking for more cost savings. They're looking for access to relevant skills. And especially in this new world of the AI economy, they're looking for workers that have those skills to build, whether it's building models or actually doing any variety of work, but using the cutting edge AI tools that are coming to market now. So we're really solving all of those problems for businesses using freelance talent, using independent talent, and also payroll talent. So we really do it all for businesses that are working in the most modern ways.
We've talked, you opened the AI door, so I'm gonna kind of walk through it at this point. It's not just AI in terms of the types of jobs that your clients or customer base are moving into to help companies with. It's also that Upwork is embarking on an AI journey of its own. I wonder if you might take us through what Upwork is doing with regard to this artificial intelligence craze that's been happening, and what exactly Upwork's role is outside of placing jobs into AI. How is it using AI to transform itself into the next generation evolution of what Upwork can be?
Yeah, this is a huge theme for us. And we had a big release this week with a number of features coming to market. We launched Uma, which is Upwork's mindful AI. And that is powering the intelligence behind a number of key features on our site, such as our job post generator, our best match algorithm. But Uma is also the first step towards offering our customers an intelligent work companion that can do many more tasks for them as they're going through their Upwork journey. And our vision here is really offering a solution that lets customers go from an idea to an outcome, from a dream to getting that delivered using artificial intelligence on Upwork. So the release that we had this week was really just the beginning of that journey and that bigger vision. I'll also add that from our talent perspective, we already see that Upwork freelancers are using artificial intelligence tools at a tremendous rate. Internal surveys show that 54% of freelancers on our platform are using AI tools on a regular basis. And that is massive compared to only 20% of freelancers on average in the broader economy, and only 9% of internal corporate employees using these tools. So the talent on our platform is already at the cutting edge of using these tools and technologies. And we ourselves are supercharging this by doing partnerships with all kinds of the most premier businesses that are offering these tools and putting those tools in the hands of talent so that they are the most productive, the most effective, and the most skilled at using this, because we're building the destination for the most AI-empowered talent in the world.
So it sounds, Hayden, like you're putting tools in place for potential freelance workers who would use your platform to better, more efficiently use it. What exactly does that mean? The executive assistant type or co-pilot, I don't want to brand them, but, you know, a co-pilot type approach to this. What exactly can you get benefit-wise from being a freelancer on Upwork? And then how, by extension, do companies who get placed with these workers get the benefit as well?
Yeah, the benefit for talent is evident, because when they get preferential access to tools like, for example, our Upwork Chat Pro, which has intelligence built in to help them complete jobs faster, to get assistance using their own data around the work that they're doing every day on our platform, it lets them earn more money. It lets them save on the tools that they would have to buy in the free market at a more expensive rate. So it really helps them build their businesses more effectively. For clients, you know, they're looking for the best solution for talent that they need with the skills that are absolutely relevant in today's economy. And they want to save money in terms of getting work done effectively. You know, they want to get productivity from their workers. And so Upwork is the destination where they can find those sought after skills and do so at a very effective rate, because these workers are highly productive, much more productive than what they can find in other places. And it saves them from having to upskill and retool internal populations of employees that may not be learning as quickly or would be very expensive to retool themselves.
And Hayden, just a few moments left here. What's the hottest part of the jobs market right now in your mind?
On our platform, it's the AI skills category. We saw it grow 50% in the past quarter, and that is on top of quadruple digit growth last year. So this is a huge theme, and I think it's going to continue to be for quite some time.
It all comes back to AI. Hayden Brown at Upwork, thank you very much. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Well, we've got a news alert now on Paramount. Julia Borson, of course, has the story. Julia.
Well, source close to the situation confirms that Sony and Apollo together have made a non-binding expression of interest in discussing a $26 billion all-cash offer for Paramount Global. So what this really means here is that they reach out and say, this is what we would want to pay. Can we talk about it? So my source tells me that Apollo and Sony understand that Paramount cannot engage at this point because of their exclusive negotiations with Skydance. Those are set to expire this week. They could also be extended if Paramount and Skydance decide to extend them. But for now, they wanted to put this offer out there and to say, hey, we want you to know that this is what we're thinking about. $26 billion all-cash offer. Can we talk about it? This was first reported that this letter was submitted to Paramount by the Wall Street Journal. We've confirmed those details, and we'll see if we get any comment. For now, we got a no comment from Sony. We've reached out to Paramount and have not heard back yet. Back over to you.
Julia, is this just about the dollars and cents? Is it just about the highest price tag? Or is this about which suitor, potential suitor, is the best fit and a balance between that and price?
I think it's the latter, Dom, because this is such a different structure, a full all-cash offer versus what's effectively a merger between Skydance and Paramount. You have Sony, which has its assets. You have Skydance, which owns 50% of some of the key IP that Paramount owns, such as Top Gun. So these are very different types of structures of deals. We also have to remember here that Sherry Redstone is the controlling shareholder through National Amusements of Paramount Global. So she's the ultimate decider here. But there's been a lot of talk about how Skydance may be sweetening their deal for the Class B shareholders who are the minority shareholders, and the question of how that might influence the deal. And of course, shareholders, if they feel like this is whatever deal happens is not in their best interest, then they may file lawsuits. So a complex decision tree here for sure. But right now we have Skydance and Paramount Global in those exclusive negotiations. Now Paramount Global knows what the other option actually is, or has a better sense of it.
Now, Julia, one more point before we let you go here. The reporting that's been done so far has also been because of that merger aspect between Skydance, potential merger, I should say, hypothetical between Skydance and Paramount. There was also a question about valuing what Skydance is as a company, what it brings to the table. How exactly will that play out, given the fact that we now have this kind of potential deal brewing with Sony and Apollo?
Well, I think that's all part of the equation here and all part of trying to figure out what this new company is. Is it a publicly traded standalone entity, a combination of Skydance, Paramount Global, or is it folded in to this Sony business? And if you have to understand that Sony obviously has this huge movie business as well, but Skydance's assets are smaller but more specifically aligned with Paramount in that they do own 50% of Top Gun, of Star Trek, and the like. So very different types of companies. Skydance, a newer and smaller media company, Sony, obviously a giant.
All right, Julia Borson with the latest there. Thank you very much. Coming up on the show, the closing arguments in the government's antitrust suit against Google started today. While it could be months before we get an actual decision, the case might already be having a big impact on the search giant. That story is coming up next. And by the way, Berkshire Hathaway, have you heard of it? Annual shareholder meeting is this Saturday. Well, CNBC will be there. Live coverage starts at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time. You don't want to miss it. Big coverage from Omaha. The Exchange is back after this. Welcome back. Closing arguments in the landmark antitrust trial between the Justice Department and Google started today. The DOJ accusing Google of abusing its power to maintain a monopoly in the business of search engines. Deirdre Bosa is here taking a look at the challenges ahead for the tech giant and this case overall. Dee, this is a big deal because it could be one of those kind of precedent centers for big tech.
Exactly. And so the closing arguments that'll happen today, they're important, but the ruling is still weeks or even months away. And that may ultimately matter less than the damage potentially already done to Google's market position. If you take the examples of Microsoft and IBM antitrust trials in the past, they actually won those, but they lost momentum in their markets. It is still too early to tell if that's true for Google, but the fear is that the same could be true of Google and generative AI, that under the pressure of regulators, it's been hesitating or even second-guessing itself. Now, take a look. These are just a handful of the chatbots that are right now available to consumers. While Google's Search Generative Experience, SGE, it remains in beta mode. The company talks about moving boldly yet responsibly. Now, the trial has revealed that a big part of the reason Microsoft made such a large investment in OpenAI is because it felt threatened by Google's lead in generative AI. A separate report earlier this week said that Apple's working on an AI-enabled Safari browser alongside new operating systems. That could be in response to another finding from the DOJ trial, that Google paid Apple $20 billion to be its default search engine in 2022. So, Dom, even as the DOJ looks at Google's search dominance, that could impact Google's position in the next race, which, of course, is Gen AI.
Let's talk about the competitive dynamic here, Deirdre, really quickly. I'm on my Instagram feed right now, which is, of course, owned by Meta. And as I go to the search bar, it is now, the search bar says, ask Meta AI anything. This is becoming ubiquitous across all of big tech. Who's got the lead and who is everyone chasing and just how successful can they be?
Depends on what you mean by the lead. Who has the best technology? There's a leaderboard on a site like Hugging Face that tells you, but for the consumer, right, it doesn't really matter. They're all going to basically do around the same thing. You don't necessarily need the most advanced version. So then you look at something like distribution. Nobody really comes near Google, right? Everyone uses Google Search many, many times a day, billions of users. What does it do with that distribution? Can it leverage that to sort of get away, to get ahead and put its generative AI into the hands of those billions of users? So the example you just brought up, when you opened up your Instagram or your WhatsApp or your Facebook, any of the family of apps that Meta makes, they're utilizing their own distribution, also with billions of users, to get them using and experimenting with generative AI. So that's kind of the at issue here, right? Can you get it in the wild? Should you get it in the wild? Because there are, as we know, so many issues and problems with hallucinations and misinformation. But it's a race here, and Google's trying to balance that responsibility with being bold while the regulators are already looking at it.
And, of course, by using all of these AI tools, we're just giving all these companies more information by which to train their models with. All right, Deirdre, thank you very much for that. Coming up on the show, near-term options in Apple shares imply a 4% move in either direction for that stock on the heels of earnings. Our trader sold her long late last year and has been bearish in 2024. Shares are down nearly 11% year-to-date. The price level she sees for Apple in the near term, that's coming up next. Welcome back to The Exchange. It's time for Earnings Exchange. Today we've got Apple, Hershey's, and Cloudflare on the docket. So here with the trades are Danielle Shea, the Vice President of Trading for Options at Simpler Trading. We're going to kick things off with the headliner. Of course, Danielle, it's Apple. The tech giant reports after the closing bell today. The street is watching for, of course, iPhone revenues and of China demand, amongst other things. Danielle, you've been bearish on Apple so far this year, and you've been correct, to be fair, and to give you some props. How exactly are you trading Apple today? When is enough enough? And can the bulls have anything to hang their hat on?
So when you look at Apple and you look at the way that megacap tech has reported this year, we've seen tickers that have beat EPS estimates and continue to trade lower. And that's been the trend with Apple as well. So I think that Apple is under quite a bit of critical resistance. And with about a $6 expected move, I expect it to trade into the lows on the year. And here's the thing is that if it breaks those lows on the year at 165, it could easily flush down into 160 or even 150. So I'm definitely bearish this stock.
All right. Next up is Hershey. Cocoa prices are falling about 20% this month, but hitting a record high just back in the month of March. Just one of the rising costs that could pressure margins. Edward Jones is writing that Hershey could respond with price increases or shrinkflation, smaller pack sizes. What's the trade on Hershey, Danielle?
So with Hershey's, what I'm noticing is that the implied move in the options market is about 4.5%, but this stock typically only moves around 2%. So generally with this stock, what I do is I come in and I sell the at-the-money puts and calls, buy some outer wings for protection, and just trade the vol crush overnight. I will note, however, if it trades up above $200 a share, that's where investors need to be on the lookout, because that's where the trend could change in this stock.
All right, so that's the trade for Hershey. And the volatile cocoa trade as well. And finally, let's talk about Cloudflare. Guggenheim is writing, it's set up for a beat and a guidance raise as Cloudflare set initial full-year guidance, quote, as if no new business was signed in the first quarter at all. While the firm says that's unlikely, it's still cautious, keeping an eye on annual recurring revenues and product cross-selling as well. Cloudflare, a big name for the tech trade. What's the trade here?
I like Cloudflare. I own this stock, and it's had a recent bullish trajectory. Last quarter, it gapped up 21%. So I think that there's a shot here that this thing can trade higher. But I will note that this quarter, we've seen a lot of disappointment, even when companies beat. So what I'm doing with this stock is I'm holding it to the long side. And if it breaks out up above 95, which, by the way, with a 15% implied move in the options market, it's entirely possible, I'm going to be adding more long shares at this price point.
95 is the level to watch there. Intraday right now, $87.67. Danielle Shea of Simpler Trading, thank you very much. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for the exchange. Power Lunch is coming up on the other side of this quick break. Markets holding on to some fractional gains right now. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.